Hello everyone and welcome back to our video lecture on Middle English. Today we're going to be introducing the Middle English period. This is the first of two lectures on Middle English. And the Middle English period starts with 1150 and continues on to 1500. 1500 is the transition point between Middle English and Early Modern English. We're going to talk about a few aspects of the language today. We're going to first start by talking about the influence from first Anglo-Norman and then French more generally in the history of English. So this is going to pick up on the last lecture in which we talked about external influences and add a new player to the game. We're going to talk about sources for Middle English and the spelling system that we find in those sources, or rather spelling systems plural, because Middle English is extremely diverse. We'll talk about the sound system and sound changes that it undergoes. Then we'll talk about nominal morphology and verbal morphology, and everything else we'll cover in the following week. If you want to read more about Middle English, you can look at the textbook by Horriban and Smith from 2002. This is a good source. It has information more than you need, but certainly enough, hopefully, to answer any niggling questions that you might have. So what's going on during this Middle English period? One of the major developments is that England as a country becomes a literate society. Obviously, this has to be seen in gradual terms. In Old English, in the Old English period, there were people who were literate. In the Modern English period, there are people who are literate. It's just the proportion of those people goes up hugely during the period in question. So what we see is in Anglo-Saxon England, we have about 2,000 writs and charters, so these are legal texts, usually short legal texts. And in the 13th century, which is when Middle English really proliferates, the new texts from Middle English really proliferate, we get tens of thousands of texts. So the increase is huge here between Old English and Middle English. There's also an increasing prestige in the English language. So in the Old English period, English was prestigious. Between the Old English period, between the Norman Conquest and 1300, English was to some extent not seen as prestigious. And we see hints of this in the texts of the time. We might see some of this later on. People actually feel the need to defend the fact that they're writing in English at all. After 1300, though, English then re-emerges as a language that can be used essentially for all purposes. And this is the prelude to the standardization that we're going to see when we talk about the early modern and modern periods. We shouldn't overestimate this gap. It's not like English suddenly disappeared overnight after the Norman Conquest and then re-emerged like a sort of phoenix from the flames in the 14th century. Elaine Trehan, in a book from 2012, for which the references are given at the end, has quite clearly shown that there was a lot of manuscript activity. A lot of English texts were being produced during this intervening period between 1066 and 1300, though largely not original texts. Rather, they were copies of texts from the Old English period. So we shouldn't overstate this. But nevertheless, there are clear signs that the prestige of English is on the rise around 1300. And certain dates can be cited as evidence for this. So obviously, the crucial one is 1066, the date of the Norman Conquest, probably the most famous date in the history of the English language, possibly the most famous date in English history altogether. In 1244, that's nearly 200 years later, it becomes illegal to hold land in both France and England. So where the Norman Conquest introduced a new class of landowners who were essentially an international elite of a kind, they were landowners in both France and England, after a while that becomes illegal. In 1244, that becomes not something that you're allowed to do. Shortly after that, in 1258, we get King Henry III, using both English and French as official languages. The novelty here is that before this, only French was really used by the monarchs, the rulers. A little bit later, we get English first being used at the University of Oxford, which previously, again, conducted most of its business using not even so much French, actually, but mostly Latin. And in 1362, Edward III, another king, opens Parliament in English, which again was a big deal because prior to this, Parliament was largely something that people did in French. So these are all developments to do with how the English language is viewed to a large extent by the people who actually spoke it. The first main issue we're going to discuss in this lecture is the influence of Anglo-Norman and or French. Anglo-Norman and French are not two terms for exactly the same thing. Rather, Anglo-Norman is a specific type of medieval French. French in general, you're probably well aware of, it's not spoken all that far from Constance itself. It is an Indo-European language, specifically a Romance language. It descended from Latin, specifically from Vulgar Latin, from the Latin that the ordinary people of the late Roman Empire in the provinces would have spoken. Obviously, the important historical event that causes French to become particularly relevant is the Battle of Hastings in 1066, when William the Conqueror, a Norman, takes over rule of Britain. Now, obviously, there would have been contact with French people before that. It's important not to overstate the difference. There was trade with the continent throughout the history of Britain. And in fact, one thing that the economic history of Britain shows is that it has done a lot better when it has had stronger trade connections with Europe, such as during the Roman and slight an early post-Roman period, during the Old English period, to some extent too, and thereafter. So we have the takeover by William the Conqueror in 1066, and William is specifically a Norman. The Normans were French, but they were also called Normans because they were Northmen. Originally, they were Vikings who had been raiding the north of France. So just like the UK had its Vikings, France had its Vikings too. And just like in the UK, the Vikings settled and ended up speaking the indigenous language. Why is it important to distinguish Anglo-Norman from other varieties of French, though? Well, one thing is that Norman French was, and still is, different from other varieties of French. So, in Norman French, que before a is retained. So you get que words like castle, rather than in standard French you would get château, where an original que from Latin castel has become a sh. So this palatalization process that we see in mainstream French does not take place in Norman French, which is how we can recognize that many of these early borrowings, such as castle itself, actually come from Norman. The same thing holds for Norman French has a special pronunciation of Romance g. So we have words like guarantee and regard with a g. And we also have words like warranty and reward. And what's interesting is that these words are essentially the same word, that they are cognates with one another. They were inherited from Latin, from Proto-Romance. But in Latin, in Norman French, you get a w. And then these words end up getting borrowed twice into English. Once with the w, as in warranty and reward, and once with a g, as in guarantee and regard. So this is quite a striking feature of Norman French, Anglo-Norman, that sets it apart from other varieties. Now, we can divide the French influence into two phases. Phase 1 is before 1250, and phase 2 is after 1250. Phase 1 is really the Anglo-Norman phase, and actually, the words borrowed during this period are not hugely many. It's comparable in scale to the Scandinavian influence, for instance, that we've seen earlier on. And from this period we get words, administrative words, but not only administrative words, like baron and servant and messenger, also other words like story. So there are a fair few words from the Anglo-Norman period, but where things really start to heat up is during the second phase, after 1250, and here the main language of influence is actually French, Parisian French, if you like. This is a period when a huge number of words, up to 10,000, are borrowed, and this doesn't stop. And they're all types of words, so nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs, mostly, almost exclusively not closed class words, that's the whole point, open class words. These are almost exclusively open class words, that is, there is not a fixed number of nouns or a fixed number of verbs. You can always add new ones to your language, whereas something like conjunctions or auxiliaries, you have a small and limited number of them. So these borrowings are open class words. Anglo-Norman, interestingly, survived in the British Isles. It was never spoken by the majority of the population, but nevertheless, people like Rothwell and Richard Ingham have shown that Anglo-Norman survived for longer than people previously thought, and it was taught in school. So it's not something that was a dead language in any meaningful sense. Generally, the earlier a French loan is, the harder it is to recognise, largely because of the form that the word takes. Another point about the influence from French is that it is almost exclusively lexical. In syntax, for instance, the relative clauses which start with a WH word might be widespread because of French influence. So these are sentences like, the man who I met, or the book which I read, rather than the man that I met, or the book that I read. This type of relative clause may be due to French influence, but it also may be, to some extent, an independent phenomenon. We can't really be sure. So that's a potential bit of syntactic influence. On the whole, the influence is on the lexical level. We also find some morphological and phonological effects, which I will come to. So here are some of the domains into which French words are borrowed, and there are really quite a lot of them. So government words, we have the word government itself, to govern, royal, state, authority, prince, duke, duchess, tax. These are hardly rare or unusual words. There are also many words in the legal domain, judge, jury, punishment, in the domain of learning, academic knowledge, so things like study, logic, infinity, surgeon. In art and fashion, we find words like art itself, music, colour, figure, poet, many, many words for food. We've got dinner, we've got cream, feast, appetite, bacon, lots of good things there. In religion, we have a great number of words as well, and we also have words that are more general words that it's very difficult to assign to a specific thematic area, like abandon or change or improvement. So we can see that the borrowing here was quite extensive. It didn't much affect the very hardcore of the top 100 most frequent words. But certainly when you look at the top 1,000 most frequent words or the top 10,000 most frequent words, there are a lot of words from French here. Alongside the purely lexical influence, we have morphological influence, because Anglo-Norman and later French causes derivational prefixes and suffixes to enter the language. Remember, derivational prefixes and suffixes are those endings or beginnings that make a new word out of an existing word, a new lexeme out of an existing lexeme. And this is interesting because these prefixes and suffixes are originally borrowed as parts of words. They're not separately borrowed. So endings like itty, as in majority, us, as in glorious, as in honour and colour, these abstract endings are borrowed, but they're borrowed with the words that they belong to. And we can see that because mostly these suffixes, especially in the Middle English period itself, are only used with words of French or Latin origin. There are some words that are exceptions to this. So endearment, for instance, is a word which has an English root. Dear is a Germanic root, comes from Old English. But en and ment, the prefix and the suffix, come from French. Similarly, disbelief has a French or Romance prefix, dis, and then an English root, belief. Useless is the other way round. So here, the lexical, the stem, use, is a French word, and less is an inherited Germanic English suffix. But actually, these hybrids are extremely uncommon. We don't really see all that many of them. And for that reason, people who've studied this have concluded that the influence of Anglo-Norman and of French on the morphology is not actually all that deep. There is some, but it starts out very superficial. Obviously now, that has changed. Some of these suffixes are the most productive suffixes in the English language. Able, for instance, A-B-L-E. This is a suffix that you can use with all kinds of words. This also comes from French. So it starts out, maybe this influence at a relatively shallow level, and takes a while to percolate through the language. So here's an overview. This is a table that you saw last time, but we've added in a row for French, and this includes Anglo-Norman. And we can compare it to the other languages in the areas of vocabulary, morphology, and syntax. In terms of vocabulary, French is the language from which arguably the most words are borrowed. So very much, yes, there was a lot of lexical vocabulary borrowing, especially in the period after 1250. We can also say that, yes, there was morphological influence, which we don't see, for instance, from Celtic or Latin, or at least not anywhere near the same extent. But as far as syntactic contact effects, syntactic influences concerned, we don't really see very much, if we see anything at all. So French is very much a lexical influencer in the history of English. There's another point that we need to touch on before leaving the issue of language contact, and that is the question of whether Middle English is a Creole. This is a huge question, and I'm not going to be able to do justice for it today, but it's worth reading up on if you're interested. Textbook Chapter 5, Section 7 has some details of this debate. And a number of scholars have argued that Middle English is a Creole, that the language contact situation, either with French or with Scandinavian, was so intense that it's better to see Middle English not as the descendant of Old English, but rather as a new language completely. And the debate on this goes back and forth. For a recent view that's fairly positive towards the idea that Middle English is at least creolized, you can read John McWhirter's 2008 book, which is very short and well written for a more general audience. Probably the consensus among specialists in the history of English is that this is overstating the case, that Middle English is not a Creole because the language contact effects that we see in Middle English don't seem to be of the extent that we see in Creoles. And here it's worth making a note of what Creoles actually are. There isn't consensus on this either, but a Creole is a natural language that is spoken by native speakers. It has native speakers. It's not a purely transactional language, and it's developed from a mixture of other languages. And there's a huge general debate about pidgins and Creoles, which is all about whether they exhibit linguistic simplification. The prototypical case of Creole are those developed during the colonial period and through slavery. And so there's a heavy socio-political element to this debate as well. So this is ongoing. There is very little agreement. And if you study varieties of English in future, you may find out more of this. But I'm not going to dwell on it right now. There's a wide range of Middle English texts, and the range here is much wider than what we see in Old English. Certain types of texts are attested during this period for the first time, and certain types of writers we also find for the first time. So here's a very colourful overview of some of the kinds of text that we have. We have government documents, and on the non-fiction side of things, scientific works, recipes, travel accounts. Travel accounts are a bit borderline, some of them are more like fiction and some of them less. And of course we've got poetry, we've got plays, we've got romances, we've got lyrics, all kinds of more creative text production as well. So there is a huge range during this 350-year period from 1150 to 1500. Some of the major works are given on this slide. On the left, you can see the Ormulum. This is a text written in the 12th century by a monk called Orm. What's special about this is that the orthography that Orm uses is something that he has pretty much entirely invented himself, as far as we can tell. And he is very careful to represent certain kinds of phonetic distinctions that other writers don't represent. From the roughly the same period, the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th, we have Lyman's Brut. This is an epic poem about the history of England, written in early Middle English. There are more chivalric or romantic texts like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. This is also a poetic text. This text is from somewhat later. In the picture there, what you can see is the Green Knight himself having been decapitated, holding aloft his own severed head. You can take a look at that in more detail on the cover slide to this section. We have Chaucer in this period. Chaucer is the most famous of the Middle English writers, probably the most famous pre-1500 English writer of all, and he wrote all kinds of things. Chaucer himself was a government employee, and he not only wrote creative texts such as the well-known Canterbury Tales, but also a lot of other types of texts too, such as scientific texts. So Chaucer was very, very productive, very linguistically creative and very linguistically aware. Another thing that's quite exciting about the period of Middle English is that we get letters from this period. These are personal letters that individuals are writing to one another. We don't see this for Old English at all. So the Paston letters, for instance, are examples of individuals writing to one another about personal matters. And this is great because this kind of language is quite likely to be less standardized and closer to speech than other written genres, though of course it is still not spoken language. These aren't the only works, there are a load of others. We've got the West Saxon History of the Holy Rood Tree. This is a very early Middle English text. We've got the Catherine group, preserved in the Bodley 34 manuscript. These are, to a large extent, saints' lives, once again, and these come from the southwest Midlands of England in the early 13th century. The Cursor Mundi, another long poem. We have various manuscripts of this. Excitingly, from around 1300, we have a northern manuscript, and this is important because manuscripts from north of the River Humber are very rare in this early period. In the period before 1300, and they only start to emerge after that. Other famous texts include Langland's Piers Plowman, which is from West Midlands from the late 14th century. The Mort d'Arthur, this is the origin of Arthurian romance in Britain. This text emerges in the East Midlands, written by Malory in the late 14th century again. We also get Wycliffe, essentially early Protestant, who was active in the southeast Midlands along with his followers in the late 14th century. And in fact, in the early 15th century, Wycliffe was very influential on people like the famous reformer Jan Hus, who the Council of Constance ended up burning at the stake. In fact, the Council of Constance did not like Wycliffe either. So they ordered that his body be dug up. He died peacefully of natural causes, but they dug his body up and then burned it, just to make the point a little bit more clear. Translating the Bible into English, as Wycliffe had done, was not something that the Catholic orthodoxy really condoned at this time, and they got very angry with people who did it. We also have drama texts like the York plays. These are northern texts from the 15th century, and the textbook contains more detail on these texts. You can also check them out yourselves at luminarium.org. So there's a massive array of texts there for you to peruse. As regards the spelling, what we find is that the early Middle English texts retain symbols such as the ash, the yog, the thorn, and the ev that we should see remember from Old English. So Lyman's Brut, in the late 13th century, on the right-hand side, you can see in this text you can see a few thorns and eves and other such things. Here, looks like we've got an ev, we've got a thorn here, tha, and so on. So in the late 13th century, we've still got all of these Old English specific characters, but relatively quickly the ash disappears and is simply replaced by an a, and the ev also disappears, and it loses its place to the TH digraph. And finally, thorn also disappears. Thorn is replaced by the TH digraph as well. So that's where essentially the modern orthography of English comes from. And by the early modern English period, what we see when we look at those texts is that the alphabet, at least, is basically the same as it is today. And that's also true of late Middle English texts. One thing that's interesting, if you've ever seen a shop called something like Ye Olde Shoppie, this ye is unhistorical. It's a ye because if you think about the thorn symbol, if you just open up the loop of the thorn, in this late period, that's what scribes started doing. And then it looks like a Y, and that's where this tradition of ye olde comes from. The ye ye was never pronounced like that. It just came from what looked like that was a thorn. It was a the oldie shoppy. And each text is unique in as far as its orthography is concerned. We saw with Old English that there was some degree of similarity because the people who were writing in Old English were largely trained in the same place, in places like Winchester. But in Middle English, we have much more diversity. So spelling is extremely diverse during this period. The most radical would be something like the Ormilum, which I showed you earlier on, but there's a huge amount of variation in general. Other spelling changes that we see, some of these are probably due to French scribal influence. So you get an influx of scribes who are used to writing in French. They start writing things differently. So a word like queen, queen, in Old English was written with a C and W, and the QU spelling comes from French. Old English had a qu sound, and it was written as an H followed by a W. In Middle English, this comes to be written as a W followed by an H, sometimes just a W, or sometimes also a QU. This is something that you'll particularly see in sources from the north, and in particular from Scots, early Scots texts. Like I said, Old English ev and thorn disappear and get replaced by the TH digraph. The Old English digraph SC, pronounced as sh, as in ship, gets replaced by the SH that we know of today. The letter C on its own, which was very ambiguous in Old English, gets replaced by CH, C, and K, depending on the word. This is not entirely systematic. Old English OU gets replaced by the OU digraph, though this was not pronounced as a diphthong during this period. This is one of the features that's probably due to French scribal influence. And finally, the Old English H, as in words like nicht, night, NIHT, start to be written with either a yog or a gh, and the gh is of course the pronunciation, is of course the spelling that we see today in words like night, N-I-G-H-T, even though this is not pronounced in any way at this period. So the yog and the symbol y are apparently introduced precisely for this purpose, to replace the h. What's interesting about yog in Middle English is it's really a grapheme distinct from g. It stands for a different sound, a palatalized sound. It's not so ambiguous as the Old English g. So that's why you will see yogs in representations of Middle English texts much more often than you will in Old English texts, even though the symbol itself was around much earlier. You also see double vowels being used in this period for long vowels. So Old English borg was written with a single O, and there was no distinction in the Old English orthography between, for instance, gord, meaning good, and god, meaning god. They were both written the same, G-O-D. The habit of writing the longer vowel with two instances of the same vowel is something that arises during the Middle English period. The sounds of Middle English change quite a lot as well, and we're going to explore some of those changes in this section. As far as the vowels are concerned, the main difference is that the Middle English system moves from a system of vowels distinguished mainly by quantity, by vowel length, remember that each short vowel had a long counterpart, to a system where quality plays the crucial role. So in the vowel quadrilateral on the right, you can see the green vowels there are the new ones. They're the new vowels that have emerged. So as well as the E, U, E, O, and A, we get a ton of new vowels such as I, U, E, E, O, Oi, and A. And these vowels are basically taking over some of the role of the long vowels. There are still long vowels in Middle English, but the system becomes much less based on vowel length and much more based on quality. The rounded U sound that we see, we still have this sound in modern-day French and German. It's the sound in German words like über, and this becomes a unrounded sound, E. So the rounded front vowel, high rounded front vowel disappears. As for this oi sound, this emerges into the English language through French borrowings. So this seems to be an instance where there is phonological influence from French. Another thing that happens, which may also or may not be to do with French influence, is that the voiceless fricatives are now phonemically distinct. If you remember when we talked about Old English, what we said about the voiced fricatives was that they existed, but they were allophones. They only occurred in voiced environments. They were allophones of the same fricative phoneme. So voicing was not phonemically distinct in fricatives in Old English. But the voiced fricatives emerged during the Middle English period. So we start to get minimal pairs with initial V. For instance, vat versus fat. Sip versus zip in modern English. And this is a contrast that emerges during the Middle English period. Otherwise, the consonant system basically looks the same as it did in Old English. Nothing much has changed here. Some consonants are deleted during the Middle English period. For instance, H. And H dropping is something that's often thought to be a modern development. So it's something that's often associated with southeastern estuary English varieties. But it's actually something that we see in Middle English as well. And it's represented sometimes in the orthography. So we have examples, this one from Lyman's Brut, ich habe, so this is like ich habe, but there is no H here, the H has been dropped off. I have in my castle 7,000 Kämpfer, 7,000 fighters. And then we've got a Wycliffe example, but je wollen lade at an Uhr in his Licht. This Uhr is an hour, and just like in modern English, the H isn't pronounced. So this H dropping starts in consonant clusters where it's very consistent. Old English has clusters of an H plus a liquid, so like chlaf meaning loaf and chrador meaning rather, and the H just gets dropped off the front of all of these words. And the H dropping spreads to other contexts as well. Other consonants are lost too. In the coda of a syllable is dropped, or sometimes it becomes a th. So in Tochter, meaning which is like German Tochter, daughter, this ch consonant disappears entirely. We don't pronounce it at all in modern English. Similarly, Seach, meaning saw, this ch is lost. And finally, in Knicht, the ch is lost. Even though the orthography still retains it, it is not pronounced, as in words like night. Another word which is relevant would be laughter, which starts out as chleachtor, like dochtor with a ch, but in this case the syllable final ch becomes a f, it becomes a labiodental voiceless fricative instead. That's also something that can happen. Between a consonant and a back vowel, W disappears. The spelling varies, but the basic development remains the same. So, swa from Old English becomes so, the w disappears, and the a raises. Swilj becomes such, twa becomes to. Now, again, this is a word like the next word. It's a word with a W in the orthography, but there is no W pronounced. It's not pronounced twu, and sword is not pronounced sword, though this orthography does preserve evidence of its historical pronunciation, as in Old English, sweard. But the W is lost in this context. Nasals and liquids often either disappear or go elsewhere, and there are a few examples of that on the bottom of the slide. Beort becomes bright. Actually, this is a case of metathesis, where a liquid changes place. This is also something that we often see in the history of English. The velar fricative r, which is represented by a g in the Old English texts, becomes either a y or a w. So we have words in Old English like bora and plora with a voiced fricative, but in these words it becomes a w, as in modern English bow and plow. Similarly, the Old English word fugol, which we've seen before, would have been pronounced with a fricative, in fact, fugol. Otherwise, it's like German vogel, and this g, or rather r, disappears and it becomes a w, as in modern-day English, foul. And there are many other words that undergo similar developments. Fair, as it may once have been, fairer, this g disappears and becomes a y. And it seems to depend whether the r sound is between back vowels or after an L or an R, or not. So if it is after a back vowel, between back vowels, or after an L or an R, it becomes a W, and elsewhere it becomes a Y. So this is a nice example of regular sound change. Two different sound changes, one of them is conditioned and one of them isn't. And this explains why we have words like morrow, as in tomorrow, from the original words like morgen, in Old English, like German Morgen. Here this r has turned into a w. Why? Because it's after an r. Vowels also change. Vowels change in length. As we've seen, the length system is destabilized. Quality becomes more important than quantity in the Middle English period. Some long vowels become short, some short vowels become long. If there's a nasal or a voiced stop after a vowel, it tends to lengthen. lamb, comb, mild, and child all start out as lamb, com, mild, and chilled, and they become lengthened to something like com, mild, chilled. Obviously, we need more to happen. Mild needs to turn into mild, and chilled needs to turn into child, and that is the great vowel shift, which we will get to in two lectures' time. We find shortening occurring before certain consonant clusters, like kebte, is the word keep with a past tense ending, and that gives us things like alternations between keep and kept, rather than keep and keeped, because of the shortening that occurs before a consonant cluster. The consonant cluster here is brought on by the fact that you've got this dental preterite ending. Vowels can also change in height. So, for instance, long A raises to or in Middle English. So words like na, mast, harm, and ana become no, most, home, and one. This would have been an or in these early texts. This, interestingly, is something that only happens in non-Northern texts. And in the North, we often see this. What's curious, though, is that in the North, the orthography for short a in words like man and land is often spelled as an O in the North, but not in the South. So essentially, long and short O are the wrong way around in the North, or rather, they're the wrong way around in the South, because there's no sense that northern varieties are any more or less prestigious than any other at this point in time. So there are many changes going on, and a lot of them affect vowels, in particular vowel length. Here's an example. Piers Plowman, a West Midlands text from the 14th century. You can see some of the developments that we talked about. So the first line, in a somer season, when soft was the sonne. Here we've got we've got alliteration again, an alliterative poem on se. In the second line, I schorpe me in schruders as ihr Schäb wäre. I put clothes on as if I was a sheep. And here we've got the sh orthography rather than the earlier Old English sc. The third line is, in fact, even more interesting because the alliteration here seems to be carried by the vowel, and it suggests that the H in words like habit and hermit were not in fact pronounced. So the alliterating element here is the vowel. And if you remember, any vowel can alliterate with any other vowel in Old English. So if you pronounce this as in abit as an eremit, unholy of workers. And there are many other interesting features that you can look at in your own time on this slide. As usual, we can divide up the morphology of the period into nominal morphology, that is, the morphology that we find on things like nouns, pronouns, adjectives, and verbal morphology, the morphology that we find on verbs. Let's start with the nominal morphology. First of all, the personal pronoun system of Middle English is given on this slide. We can see that it looks a bit more like the modern English system than what we saw before. It looks a bit less like German, in other words. One thing, for instance, that's completely gone is the dual that I mentioned earlier on. The dual is dead by the Middle English period. There are new pronouns in this system. We have the third person singular feminine form she, you can see that here, and you can see the third person plural forms they, them, and there. And these replace the original he, him, and here from Old English. So there are new pronouns in this system. Other aspects behave the same. So the first person singular hasn't changed all that much. The second person singular hasn't changed all that much. It's even still pronounced the same. So this word that is in modern English usually pronounced thou would have been pronounced thou at the time. And the OU orthography is due to French scribal influence. So, we've got a few new things here. We've got the accusative merging with the dative. This is something that happens during the early Middle English period. When we get to the time of Chaucer, there is no more distinction between the accusative and the dative. So there's no distinction between direct objects and indirect objects. This is something that also happens in many other Germanic varieties, such as Dutch, and also Northern German varieties like Plattdeutsch. We also find, we find the loss of this distinction, we find new pronouns, they, their, them, and she, and we also find second person pronouns being used in a way that's a bit more like German and French. So this du pronoun, which starts out as a singular pronoun, versus je, second person plural pronoun, this starts out as a singular versus plural distinction, but during the Middle English period, it becomes a distinction between familiar and polite, or familiar and formal. And this becomes very clear if you look at texts like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. In Chaucer's The Knight's Tale, you can actually tell quite a lot about the relationships between the characters just by looking at what pronouns they use to refer to one another. So this is a really interesting feature of Middle English that wasn't there before. This develops during the Middle English period. Chaucer uses it robustly, Shakespeare uses it robustly in the early modern period as well, and then it disappears again in favour of you in all cases and all situations. It's not quite the same as it is in German, but we can brush over the distinctions here because they're not crucial for us. What's interesting is that the distinction between du and je during the late Middle English and early modern English period is quite a lot like the distinction between du and sie in German. And if you look at the texts, you can find things out by using this as a diagnostic. Where do these new pronouns come from, then? Well, both she and the forms, they, their, and them, spread from the north, more specifically, seemingly, the northeast. As for she, it may descend from the Old English demonstrative seo or seo. The Old English dictionary lists many, many variant spellings here, there would have been many variant pronunciations in this area as well. As for they, there, and them, we talked briefly about this last week. The traditional story is that these pronouns are borrowed from Scandinavian, but Marcel Kohl, in recent work, has argued that it's not borrowed from Scandinavian. In fact, it could well be a native development in Northumbrian Old English that just happened to spread southwards. In the Middle English period, this change is not complete. So the southern texts, and the southern texts in this at this point include even East Anglia, the West Midlands, and areas that are relatively far north, Manchester, for instance, is around here. These areas and these texts still have hem rather than them. There are also distinctions between the nominative and the accusative and dative forms. So, for instance, Chaucer, when he's writing later on, he uses they in the nominative, but hem in the accusative. The other thing that happens during this period as regards the pronouns is that the new self forms emerge. Himself, herself, myself, themselves. These emerge during this period. If you remember, Old English doesn't have reflexive pronouns. Old English just uses normal pronouns. Much like in German in the first person, to say, I wash myself, you would just say, ich wasche mich. I wash me. You don't have to say, ich wasche mich selbst. This self form is something that emerges during the Middle English period. Those are interesting, but they're not even the biggest changes that affect the nominal morphology of Middle English. The biggest changes are the ones that happen to nouns and adjectives. Because if you remember what we did for Old English, we spent quite a long time on the different endings that you find on nouns and on adjectives. Basically, during the Middle English period, all of that disappears. Nouns lose almost all of their case endings. They retain genitive s, as in the man's sister, with man's, but they don't retain anything else. And it's not even clear that this s in modern English is a real genitive case at all. In fact, it's almost certainly not. Early texts like Lyman's Brut have some dative singular endings in e, but even there, it's not consistent, and these endings disappear. Outside the genitive, we see ES in the plural, or just S, just like in modern English, and no ending in the singular. We also see the end of the gender system. Middle English loses grammatical gender distinctions. It loses noun classes. All nouns basically end up behaving the same, except a small set of irregulars. And the adjectives behave the same. So the adjectives also lose almost all of their endings. Many adjectives in Middle English still have an E on the end, but it's far from clear what this E actually does or what it means, and different authors might have used it differently. It's not clear that it would have always been pronounced. It's not clear whether it sometimes has a sort of case function or a weak, strong function. This is all just very, very murky territory. And another big change, of course, is that this demonstrative paradigm that we saw last time, so se, seo, thonna, tha, etc., all of these forms disappear, and all we get in the Middle English period is the. So what we've seen here is a massive reduction in forms. We see a huge loss of endings and of morphological diversity during this period. And this is the main reason that people have characterized the transition from Old English to Late Middle English as a change away from synthetic and towards analytic. This also, incidentally, is one of the reasons that people have suggested that Middle English is a Creole, because Creoles are typically languages with very little nominal morphology, or at least that is sometimes claimed. And we'll talk next time about the change from synthetic to analytic in a bit more detail in the context of the syntax of the language. Finally for today, we will talk about verbal morphology. And the verb agreement is something, again, that changes during the Middle English period. On the whole, the paradigm that's shown on this slide is something that looks quite similar to what we saw for Old English. So the verbal morphology at this stage hasn't changed all that much. It does change. And starting in the north of the country, the endings simplify, also in the verbs. Particularly at this point, the subjunctive is disappearing. It already doesn't really have its own distinct set of endings at this point. It's being replaced. The ye prefix is weakened during this time. So we still see the ye prefix, and it's still not entirely restricted to past participles. Here we see it for the verb finde, to find, gefunden, or just funden. This prefix is weakened and often lost, and this again seems to happen earlier in the north. The endings that are given on this slide is for strong verbs, and the weak verbs look the same, except that of course in the past you have the weak dental preterite ending, these endings in d, like for the verb to love, ich luvede, he luvede, du luvedest, you lovedest, and also in the past participle. So these endings with the dental preterite, rather than with a change in the vowel. So here we can see in these forms there is a change of vowel. In the indicative we have find, in the past indicative we have fond, in the plural fund. So strong verbs, as we know, form their past tense with a vowel change. Weak verbs form their past tense with a dental preterite. And these are the endings that you will find at the time of Chaucer, for instance. There is still a reasonable amount of verbal morphology at this period, and some of it survives even into the early Middle English period. An interesting feature of this period is that strong verbs become weak, often that's not the only thing that can happen here. Strong verbs can alternate with weak verbs, and some verbs can be both. So, for example, the verb to walk, Chaucer uses it both as a strong verb, as in I welk alone, with a vowel change, and also as a weak verb, in the fields walked we. So this is something where there is a substantial amount of variation. Some verbs that are now weak, like laugh and help, were still strong during this period. So Middle English, laugh, the modern past is laughed with a dental preterite, and in Middle English we would find loche or lauche with a vowel change in the past. Similarly with help, the modern past is helped, as I mentioned before, and in Middle English we found holp with a vowel change, help holp. Sometimes strong and weak pairs of verbs get completely mixed up. So Old English had two verbs, the strong verb duvan, to dive, and the weak verb duvan, to dip. These forms get confused. So the strong verb form becomes obsolete, and the verb itself changes to weak, but the meaning that is retained is the meaning of the original strong verb. So it seems like speakers got incredibly confused about these verbs during the Middle English period. Interestingly, when you get the verb dive in modern English, some people use a strong past tense dove. This is actually a recent innovation, and it's actually a rare case in which a verb that was originally weak tends to become strong. That's not something that you see very often. In general, the trajectory is the other way around. Strong verbs become weak verbs. Or, in fact, strong verbs are lost entirely. In nearly a third of Old English strong verbs were completely lost in the early part of the Middle English period. So these verbs just didn't survive. And that, again, sort of pushed the pendulum swung more towards weak verbs during this period, as it has throughout the history of the language. Here is a text with some morphological features that are of interest. So we here have a piece of Malory's Mot d'Arthur, which despite the name is written in English. So we have, in May, Juan every lusty herta flourisheth, flourishes, but with the F ending of Middle English, inherited from Old English, and burgeneth, and burgeons. Then we have, for as this season is lusty to behold, first of all, the season. We have saison, which itself is a French borrowing, and it occurs with this completely invariable definite article form, the, which is a obviously the modern definite article, and Middle English is when we see it for the first time. Behold, the infinitive to behold has an E on the end. This E infinitive ending would still have been pronounced in the Middle English period, even towards the end. And then we see a plural ending as well. Saw man and woman rejoicen. And this N ending is a plural ending of the kind that you also see in German. But when you look at nominal morphology, we've got in the next line, fresh flurs, meaning fresh flowers. And this adjective has an E on the end. Why does it have an E on the end? God only knows. I certainly don't. This E could mean anything. It could just be orthographic, or maybe it has some function or other. And the plural here is an ES plural, which is the kind of noun plural that really takes over the language. We see it at the end of the line as well. Winter with his rough winds. Interestingly, Malory, although he's lost Ev and Thorn, and the ash, he still uses yog, so we can see in this line, rough, which would have been pronounced ruch at this point, probably, still has this yog at the end, rather than a gh. So those are some of the morphological features that we see in the Middle English period. On the one hand, we can see that things are starting to look more like the modern language. On the other hand, there are still a lot more endings than we see in modern English, and a lot more distinct endings, like the en plural ending on verbs and the eth ending on verbs. All right, then, to summarise, Middle English is a period when a huge amount changes, and we're lucky enough to have documents that show us the progress of this change. During the Middle English period, orthographically, there is a lot of change because the specific graphemes that are found in the Old English period, ev, thorn, ash, and yog are lost, and the alphabet by the end of the Middle English period looks like it does today. There are also many sound changes in Middle English, and these include the emergence of glides, more glides, deletion of consonants such as initial H, and changes in vowel length from long vowels to short vowels and short vowels to long vowels. Also, at this stage, we see that quality of vowel makes a more important contribution to the overall system than quantity does. Nouns and adjectives, in the meantime, have lost almost all of their endings. The pronoun system is changing dramatically. The verbal endings are starting to simplify, but we still see quite a lot of the verbal endings from Old English retained in the Middle English period. Finally, many strong verbs during this period either disappear entirely or shift to weak forms. So they start using a dental preterite rather than a vowel alternation. And this is a common trend in the history of English. Your task for next time is firstly to look at exercise 4 from the textbook, page 147. Also to look at text 4 in the text on Ilias. This is a text by the man himself, Geoffrey Chaucer, and you can use this text to spot morphological differences. I want you to focus on the morphological differences, both in terms of comparing Old English and Middle English, and in terms of comparing present-day English with Middle English. If you want to have an audio version of this text, to have an idea of how it would have been pronounced, you just need to follow this link. So you can hear someone pronouncing the general prologue to Chaucer, which is the text that you will be working at. All right, go to the tutorial, read the first half of chapter 6, and I will be back next time to finish off Middle English for you. And we will also, I think, be talking a bit about what's going to be on the exam. Here are the references. Have a fantastic week.